Okay, good afternoon, everybody. It is December 8th. This is your last class. A couple things in respiration I want to finish up, and that will be it pretty much. But let's see, when is our final? When's our final? Monday, yeah, so a week from today. And it's going to be, I believe, at 1 to 3 in this room. Okay, so yeah, it's going to start an hour earlier. December 15th, that's a Monday. And the stuff on the test is going to be, let's see if I know the correct chapters. It's going to be chapters, let's see. Chapters 13, 14, and 16. So 1-3, 1-4, and 1-6. All right, then we'll be done with 1-6 today. Okay. All right, so last time when we were talking about the pulmonary system, we talked about muscles of inspiration, muscles of expiration, talked about quiet breathing versus forced breathing. So what muscle is important for inspiration for quiet breathing? The diaphragm, yeah, the diaphragm is important. What about expiration? What muscles are important for expiration, for quiet breathing?
Diaphragm.
No, diaphragm is good for inspiration. But for expiration, how does air leave your lungs when you're breathing quietly? Does it require muscles?
Yes.
Or no?
No.
You know, it does not, because it's passive. Because the elastic properties of the diaphragm and also elasticity of the alveoli, right? There are elastic fibers around, and I did the experiment with the paper bag and the balloon, right? And I demonstrated that to you. Okay. Let's see. Talked about the shape of the alveolus. What's important about the shape of the alveolus? It increases surface area for exchange, right? And what kind of cells make up the alveolus? Kind of cells. Two kinds of cells make up an alveolus. There's type 1 and type 2. What's a type 1 cell? That's just a simple squamous epithelium. Makes the respiratory membrane real thin. And what's the alveolar type 2 cell do? Yeah, it makes surfactant. And we did a little demonstration last time with surfactant. What is the use of surfactant? What does it do for us? It decreases surface tension. And why is that a good thing? And where does that happen? Within the alveolus, right? Not the pulmonary space, right? Not in the pleural space, but in the alveolus, so that alveoli can inflate. Okay? Let's see. I think we talked about did we talk about spirometry? Yeah, we talked about spirometry a little bit and how to measure pulmonary volumes, because that's an important exam figure in your book. And here is an interactive exercise that you could use. This is similar to the one that's in your book. So let's expand. Okay, so what do we call this volume that you breathe in and out of your body constantly? Yeah, that's the tidal volume. So for instance, if we look over here, that would be just this volume right here. So if you want to just check yourself to see if that's tidal volume, what can you do? Click on that, tidal volume. You don't have to know the volume per se, but you should at least know what it's named. Okay, and then from the top of a normal tidal volume, you can inspire a lot more air. You can go through a forced inspiration, up to maximally inflating your lungs. So what do we call this volume? From the top of a tidal volume to a maximal inspiration right here. That's the inspiratory reserve capacity. Oh no, volume, it's a volume. Inspiratory reserve volume. All right, so inspiratory reserve volume, and then this is just a maximal inspiration right here. Furthermore, at the end of a normal tidal volume, you can force more air out of your lungs maximally, until you get to a maximal expiration. So what is this volume called? That's the expiratory reserve volume. And then there is some air in your lungs that you can never exhale. It's always stuck in your lungs because, remember, parts of the lower respiratory tract have cartilage around them. These airways are held open all the time. There's no way to compress them. And that's a good thing because if they were to compress, then you couldn't get any air out of your lungs at all. So some of these tubes are held open all the time, and they create a dead space. What do we call that volume of air that can't leave that dead space? That's the residual volume. Okay. Furthermore, we can combine some of these basic volumes, and if we combine two or three or more of these basic volumes, we can determine a capacity inside the lung. So a capacity is when we add these basic volumes together. So here is a capacity because it's made up of this volume, and this one. It's made up of the expiratory reserve volume, the tidal volume, and the inspiratory reserve volume. And that's what we call the vital capacity. So that's the amount of air that you can move in and out of your lungs to get oxygen in your body and to expire carbon dioxide. So we should see vital capacity. All right, so at this website, you can look at this graph, and maybe is it in your study guide? Is this figure in your study guide with this link? Yeah, it is. Okay, so you can find that in practice because this possibly could be on the test, for instance. Okay, so if not, just follow this link right here to look at this. Okay. All right, so we covered all this. So here, this is the one that's in your book, but you can practice labeling. Okay. Control of ventilation. And actually, moving gases around inside your body. All right, so here we have a tube. This could be a blood vessel, or this could be an airway, or it could be any kind of tube that's transporting something in your body. And if we want to increase flow through this tube, what can we do to this tube? What's a very powerful way of regulating the flow of material through a tube? By changing the diameter or the radius of the tube. Remember, the diameter of a tube is just twice the radius. All right, so if we make the blood vessel reach this configuration, what happens to blood flow? Does it increase or decrease? It increases. And how much? A little bit or a lot? And how would you know? It's, okay, so is this vasoconstriction or vasodilation right here? Vasodilation. And the blood flow is going to change, your airflow is going to change a lot because of Poiseuille's equation. It's radius to the fourth power. So when the radius changes, it gets bigger. That change is multiplied by itself four times. All right, so the flow through this tube when it vasodilates will increase very rapidly because of the fourth power rule. Okay. All right, and what part of the circulatory system undergoes the most amount of vasoconstriction and vasodilation in terms of controlling blood flow through various parts of your body? Would you say an artery? Arteriole? A vein, or what? Okay. And veins can constrict and dilate to increase or decrease venous return. But the vessel that undergoes the most change is an arteriole. Okay. And sometimes a precapillary sphincter. So here is an arteriole going to some kind of tissue. And there's smooth muscle around this arteriole. All right, and that's going to go to a capillary, and there's precapillary sphincters around the entrance to a capillary. All right, so here's a nice capillary bed. And let's just say that this capillary bed is feeding this kind of cell right here. And this kind of cell looks like this. So what kind of cell looks like this? kind of cell looks like that? Okay, I see striations right there, so I'm thinking muscle cell. Okay, so I'm thinking of a muscle cell. So what can a muscle cell do? It can contract when it's activated. And what does it use up when it's contracting? It's using up a lot of ATP. All right, but what is it producing also? It's producing lactic acid and carbon dioxide. So when this muscle is relaxed, maybe right now, okay, it's not producing any acid. It's not producing CO2. All right, so lack of CO2 and hydrogen ion, right, due to lactic acid, is going to keep these precapillary sphincters in a constricted state. They're going to be constricted. So what can you tell me about blood flow through this capillary bed when it's low in CO2 and low in hydrogen ion? This constriction right here. Is it going to be constricted or is it going to be dilated? And why? Okay, if this muscle is not contracting, what can you tell me about CO2 and hydrogen ions? Are they being produced? Not very much, right? So there's going to be a lack of CO2 and a lack of hydrogen ion. So what about the state of flow through this muscle? Do you need to have a lot of blood flow going to this muscle if it's not exercising, if it's not producing CO2 and acid? What about oxygen? Does this muscle need a lot of oxygen when it's just sitting there compared to when it's exercising is what we're going to compare that against. Okay, so it doesn't need oxygen. So under those conditions, this precapillary sphincter is going to be constricted. So blood is not going to be flowing around these muscle fibers because they don't need glucose. They don't need oxygen. They're not doing anything. Okay, so we'll just say quiet. Now what happens when this muscle starts contracting? What does it produce? Right? Lots of CO2, lots of hydrogen ions. And CO2 is going to leave the cell. It can diffuse out of the cell. It's going to go to this precapillary sphincter right here. And what's going to happen to it? It's going to vasodilate so that blood can flow to the skeletal muscle right here. And when blood flows to the skeletal muscle, it washes away CO2 and hydrogen ion, but it also brings something else to the muscle. What else does it bring to the muscle? It brings oxygen, right, and glucose, glucose and oxygen just maintain ATP so that that muscle can keep contracting. Okay, so these muscles right here are controlled by the metabolic demands of the tissue via these different chemical compounds, CO2, hydrogen ion, okay, as well as oxygen concentration. All right, so tell me what's going to happen to these precapillary sphincters in this muscle tissue when oxygen goes down. What happens when oxygen goes down in this muscle right here? What's going to happen to these precapillary sphincters? Should they constrict or should they dilate? Well, they should dilate, right? Because if they dilate, then this blood is going to bring oxygen to keep that tissue alive, right? If they're going to constrict, then that would even cut off more oxygen to these tissues, right? So this is what we call local control. Of blood flow to tissues in your body via systemic capillaries. Okay, but what we're talking about is the lungs. Okay, and I want to talk about local control in the lungs. Now, in terms of anatomy, okay, what can you tell me about the pulmonary circulation from the systemic circulation? What's a handy way of thinking about the pulmonary circulation? Let's start with the aorta. Where does the aorta belong to? Is that pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation? That's systemic circulation. And is it carrying oxygenated blood or deoxygenated blood? Oxygenated blood. And it's an artery because it's taking blood away from the heart. Okay, now what about the pulmonary circulation in the pulmonary trunk? Ah, that's what I wanted to hear or see. Okay, it's what? It's switched. Okay, so that's the important concept that I want you to appreciate here, is that the pulmonary circulation is switched compared to the systemic circulation in terms of what the blood is carrying. So in the a pulmonary artery is carrying what, oxygenated blood or deoxygenated blood? It's deoxygenated because the pulmonary circulation is backwards. So blood is going to the lungs, not to deliver oxygen, but to pick up oxygen and then eventually deliver it to the systemic circulation. Okay, so in the systemic circulation, which is what we drew on the board right here, systemic circulation, decreased oxygen does what? It vasodilates. Systemic circulation, decreased O2, vasodilates. Okay, which causes an increased perfusion of this tissue because when it's working, it needs more oxygen, needs more nutrients. Now let's look at the pulmonary circulation and see how blood flow is controlled through the pulmonary circulation. And using that concept of reversal, okay, so decreased oxygen vasodilates, right? So using that principle of comparing or contrasting the pulmonary circulation with the systemic circulation, use that same reversal principle for control of perfusion, guess what might happen in the pulmonary circulation when oxygen, okay, in the alveolus decreases? What's going to happen to arterioles in the lungs? It's going to vasoconstrict. Okay, so let's just take a look at that. So here you have an arteriole going to the lungs, and there's going to be a capillary. Here's a nice alveolus, and as oxygen concentration goes down, right, in this alveolus, what's going to happen to this smooth muscle right here? For the systemic circulation, you're going to say, well, it's going to vasodilate. Okay? But in the lungs, this is actually going to vasoconstrict and shut off blood supply to this alveolus, which is kind of a strange concept. Okay? But not in the sense of, why is blood going to this alveolus right here? Is it going to this alveolus to deliver oxygen because oxygen is low? Or is it going to this alveolus to pick up oxygen? To pick up oxygen, right? So if blood was being directed in your lungs to places where there's no oxygen, then your blood is not going to be oxygenated. Okay, so local control of perfusion, that means how blood moves through the capillary beds of the lungs, is controlled by oxygen concentration. But the parts of the lungs that are not highly oxygenated, blood flow is turned off. And so blood goes to the parts of the lungs that have high oxygen concentration. All right, so we call that perfusion ventilation matching. So blood flow goes to the parts of the lung that have oxygen. It would be very futile for blood to go to parts of the lungs where there was no oxygen, because when blood got there, it couldn't pick any oxygen up, right? And then it couldn't deliver to any of the tissues. All right, so know the difference between the systemic control, local control, versus pulmonary, local control of blood flow through the various organs. Okay, let's talk about an interesting case. Just to kind of reinforce this concept, what happens to resistance when something vasoconstricts? What happens to resistance? It increases, right? So the resistance increases, okay? And when that happens, what happens to blood pressure? What's blood pressure equal to? Okay. Blood pressure is equal to stroke volume, right, times heart rate, times resistance, right? So we're talking about the pulmonary circuit right now. So if there's a part of your lungs, or if you don't ventilate your lungs, guess what happens to the blood pressure of your pulmonary circulation? Right. If this increases, blood pressure increases. Okay. So this is sort of interesting because there's a condition, okay, that people can produce in themselves that vastly increases the resistance of arterioles through their lungs. So how could you decrease oxygen in your lungs, thereby increasing resistance, which is going to produce hypertension, pulmonary hypertension? Okay. Yeah, we talked about weightlifting. Okay, but there's a condition where people actually stop breathing for a short period of time. Okay. For instance, like during sleep apnea, when people stop breathing. So when people stop breathing, what happens to oxygen inside their lungs? It goes down. Okay, and because of ventilation perfusion matching, what happens to these arterioles? They say, oh, well, there's no sense sending blood to the alveoli because there's no oxygen there. We might as well vasoconstrict. When they vasoconstrict, the blood pressure and the pulmonary circulation skyrockets. Okay, and what can you tell me about hypertension? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah, it's a bad thing. It doesn't matter what side of the heart it is, if it's the right side or the left side of the heart. Okay, and that can produce heart failure, not on the left side of the heart, like what we're familiar with, but on the right side of the heart. So sleep apnea can kill the heart, right, because of this ventilation perfusion matching mechanism. And the terrible thing about that is, how can you measure blood pressure in your pulmonary circulation? You measure blood pressure in lab. What kind of blood pressure did you measure in lab? Was it pulmonary or systemic? Yeah, because you measured it on your arm, right? So that's from the left ventricle, but, okay, this kind of situation is developed because of what's happening in the right ventricle, and there's really no way to measure pulmonary blood pressure. So it's kind of an occult disease process, right, that catches up with people when they start to go into heart failure. They have no idea if they have pulmonary hypertension. Except when the heart is working harder to produce this pressure, it usually hypertrophies. And you can see that on an ECG. How could you measure right ventricle hypertrophy when the right ventricle gets better using ECG? I think you're saying it, but I just can't quite hear you. When you measure the mean electrical axis of the heart. Okay, so when the right side of somebody's heart hypertrophies because of pulmonary hypertension, the right side of their heart gets bigger, and the mean electrical axis has a tendency to shift way to the right because it's getting bigger. It's getting as big as the left ventricle. Okay, so that's a nice way. You can't measure the pulmonary circulation very much, or it's very difficult to, but with the ECG, was it hard to get it measure an ECG in lab? No, it was easy. Okay. So that's the importance, that's one of the important reasons why you should know something about ventilation perfusion matching in the lungs. Okay, just remember, it's opposite compared to the systemic circulation. And it's opposite because blood goes to an alveolus when? When it has no oxygen or when it's high in oxygen? When it's high in oxygen, that's when these arterioles dilate. That's the opposite circumstance in the systemic circulation. Blood doesn't need to go to this muscle if it has high oxygen. Blood needs to go to this muscle when it is low in oxygen, which is the opposite compared to the pulmonary circulation, right? So always try to remember that they kind of flip back and forth. So that's ventilation perfusion matching. Okay. Control of ventilation. I think maybe we mentioned where the respiratory control center was, and that's just in the medulla and the pons. And I think that's pretty much all I'm going to talk about the respiratory control center for your test. Okay, but I do want to mention something on this slide right here. Okay, so the point of ventilation is to adjust various gases that are in your blood and a chemical compound. And the gases that we're most interested in are oxygen and carbon dioxide. Oxygen and carbon dioxide because mitochondria need oxygen. They produce CO2, so your body needs to get rid of CO2. So there are chemoreceptors in a number of places in your body that will help adjust ventilation. Okay, so there are central chemoreceptors in the respiratory center, which is in the medulla right here. So these are what we call central because they're in the central nervous system. And then we have peripheral chemoreceptors, either in the arch of the aorta, so we call these the aortic bodies, or the carotid sinus right here, we call these the carotid bodies. And these measure a couple of different things. Okay. But before we start talking about that, we need to look at this chemical reaction right here. All right, so when CO2 is produced by your body, it can combine with water to produce carbonic acid, and carbonic acid then can dissociate into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate ion. And this is there's almost no free change in energy, Gibbs free energy. So this reaction can move to the right or it can move to the left depending on the concentration of these various chemicals. And it's catalyzed by an enzyme. And you got to know the name of that enzyme. So what's the name of the enzyme that can interconvert carbon dioxide and bicarbonate? Carbonic anhydrase is the name of that enzyme. Okay? All right, so CO2 that's produced in your body, when it's dissolved in the fluids of your body, it actually acts as an acid or a base? An acid, because it produces these hydrogen ions right here. And when we hyperventilate and we lose a lot of CO2, that means then we're going to talk about the law, all right? When you lose CO2, this reaction is going to move to the left. So hydrogen ion and bicarbonate are going to combine to eventually make CO2 that you'll breathe out of your body. All right, so what do we call that principle or law? Okay, that will rebalance this equation automatically for us. Yeah, that's Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. All right, so if we put a lot of CO2 in to a tissue fluid, if we put a lot of CO2 in, what's going to be the result of that? It's going to go to the right, it's going to produce a lot of bicarbonate, and also a lot of hydrogen ion, right, which is an acid. It's going to lower the pH. All right, so hyperventilation causes low CO2. We call that hypocapnia. And hypoventilation, when you hold your breath, that produces hypercapnia or high CO2. Okay, so carbonic anhydrase is the name of that reaction right there. All right, so would you guess, what do you think, what molecule is most important for your metabolism? Is it oxygen or CO2? Well, in order for you to make ATP, it's very necessary to have oxygen, right? So I thought forever and ever that it'd be very important for your body to actually measure oxygen concentration and adjust your respiratory rate on the amount of oxygen that's in your blood. But that's not really true. That's not how your body works, right? The brain chemoreceptors are responsible for the greatest effects on ventilation. So where are those receptors at again in the brain? In the medulla, all right? And hydrogen ion, because that's a cation right there, it can't cross the blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier is made up of those ependymal cells, so not every chemical that's in the blood can enter the brain, and hydrogen ion is one of those chemicals. But carbon dioxide can pass through, right, with no problem. And so that's why the brain monitors carbon dioxide levels, because your systemic hydrogen ion concentration can't get into the brain. So the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted to maintain arterial pCO2 at about this level right here. Right? The peripheral chemoreceptors don't respond to PCO2, only hydrogen ions. All right, so the brain is really just monitoring carbon dioxide levels. Okay, so here is a nice slide that shows, well, here is the capillary in the brain. Here is the blood-brain barrier made up of those ependymal cells. Here is cerebral spinal fluid. And then here are neurons inside the brain. And if we had hydrogen ions in the blood, could these hydrogen ions get into the cerebral spinal fluid and affect the brain? No, can't get through the blood-brain barrier. But CO2 that's being carried by the blood can. It can move right across the blood-brain barrier, and when it's in the cerebral spinal fluid, it can be converted into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. So what's the name of the enzyme that's in the CSF that allows for that to happen? What? Oh yeah, carbonic anhydrase. Good, you knew it. You just know how to say it. Carbonic anhydrase. Right, so carbonic anhydrase is catalyzing this reaction, taking CO2, converting it into bicarbonate and hydrogen ion, and these hydrogen ions then stimulate the chemoreceptor neurons in the medulla, which will increase ventilatory rate to get rid of carbon dioxide in the blood. Okay, so these chemoreceptors in the brain indirectly monitor blood CO2, okay, by looking at hydrogen ion concentration that is produced by the carbonic anhydrase reaction inside the brain. Okay, so this is probably kind of an important slide to look over. Okay, low blood oxygen has little effect on ventilation. This is pretty strange. Okay, it does influence the chemoreceptor sensitivity to carbon dioxide, so it does affect breathing to some degree. But the oxygen concentration has to fall to about half the normal value before it significantly affects ventilation. So you have to be almost dying of oxygen before that's going to stimulate inspiration. Like for instance, when somebody holds their breath and then passes out, then that very, very low concentration of oxygen is going to stimulate ventilation, but only under those conditions. So we call that hypoxic drive. So the most sensitive chemical compound that regulates ventilation, okay, take a guess. Which compound? We've got CO2 is pretty much equal to hydrogen ion. Why are these two concentrations coupled so nicely? Why are they almost the same variable in terms of controlling ventilation? Because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Okay, and the other chemical compound is oxygen. Which one of these two, carbon dioxide or oxygen, is the most powerful stimulus for controlling ventilation? Okay, so small increases in CO2 are powerful stimulus for ventilation, but oxygen, you need to have a drastic decrease in oxygen before that stimulates ventilation. So carbon dioxide is the most important controlling chemical for ventilation. Okay. Let me go back. And all right, so we have these areas right here, the central receptors. We have two peripheral receptors. And it's only the chemoreceptors in the carotid sinus that are sensitive to oxygen. So the receptors in the aortic bodies right here and the central receptors in the medulla are not sensitive to oxygen at all. All right, and the medulla and aortic bodies are sensitive to changes in hydrogen ion concentration or CO2, but the carotid sinus is sensitive to oxygen, but only barely. Okay, hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is the, let me go back and, I want to talk about this slide here. Okay. Okay, so Ventilation is just the moving of air in and out of your lungs, and that stretches the lungs. And the lungs are a fairly delicate kind of tissue. And the lungs actually could be ripped if the lungs are overinflated. So there is a reflex that prevents that from happening. And that's called the Herring-Brewer reflex. All right, and it's mediated by stretch receptors in the lungs. So the more that the lungs are inflated, the more those stretch receptors send action potentials to the respiratory center, right, that inhibits inspiration. So the Herring-Brewer reflex is a reflex that prevents overinflation of the lungs. It limits a maximal inspiration, and that's mediated by stretch receptors in the lungs. Okay, so that's maybe something that you should know about too. Okay, so we have a couple important compounds that have to be transported by the blood. They are CO2 and oxygen, and they're carried in the blood via two different kinds of mechanisms. All right, and oxygen is transported in a form that's bound to hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is a chemical compound that we find in red blood cells. Right, so the loading of oxygen onto hemoglobin occurs in the lungs and it unloads in the tissues. Right, so this is what hemoglobin looks like. And there has to be an iron molecule. There are four chains that can carry four different oxygen molecules. So this is the hemoglobin. Okay. Another kind of hemoglobin is methemoglobin. It can't carry oxygen, right? It's iron in a plus 3 state. The normal hemoglobin has iron in a plus 2 state, and it can carry oxygen. And hemoglobin, the third state that hemoglobin can be found in is what we call carboxyhemoglobin, right? Carboxyhemoglobin is when hemoglobin is combined with carbon monoxide. Okay, and do you see the difference between carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide? Yes, one oxygen versus two oxygens. And carbon dioxide comes from the complete combustion of a carbon molecule like glucose. Carbon monoxide is the result of incomplete combustion. For instance, when we actually burn carbon-based fuels in a flame, it's an incomplete combustion and produces a lot of carbon monoxide. And carbon monoxide can bind with hemoglobin to form carboxyhemoglobin. And when it binds with hemoglobin, oxygen can't bind to it. So that blocks the binding site in hemoglobin for oxygen. And so what happens under those circumstances when you block the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin? Yeah, well, it makes you dizzy, but then your blood can't carry oxygen to the tissues that need it, like your brain, for instance, heart, things of that nature. All right, and if carbon monoxide concentration is high enough, then that's lethal because that will stop the carrying capacity of the blood for oxygen completely, and you'll suffocate. So when you breathe carbon monoxide, that's like somebody grabbing you around the throat and actually preventing you from breathing. But it's what? At a chemical molecular level, not at the level of ventilation. All right, so carbon monoxide is pretty dangerous because it has an affinity for hemoglobin that's 210 times stronger than oxygen. Okay, so what does that mean? Very little concentrations of carbon monoxide can poison a hemoglobin molecule. So if here is hemoglobin, right here, and it's bound to carbon monoxide, okay, how many oxygen molecules would we have to draw in on the board right here to displace this carbon monoxide and have an oxygen sit right here to be transported by the blood? How many would I have to draw? Yeah, I'd have to draw 210 of these before these oxygens can bounce this carbon monoxide off the hemoglobin molecule. Right? So one carbon monoxide molecule out of 210 oxygens is enough to saturate hemoglobin 50%, then it has an equal chance. So very, very low levels of carbon monoxide are extremely poisonous. And about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, even in Los Angeles, that doesn't get very cold, right? There was a little cold snap, and somebody brought a barbecue into their house to warm it up, and it killed the whole family because of carbon monoxide, right? So carbon monoxide is produced by when you burn gasoline in your car or candles or barbecues or things like that. So I know it sounds pretty amazing, but I guess, you know, the economic times are such that people can't afford electricity or gas to heat their house that they think of other ways to do that. And a lot of times it can be fatal. And actually the number one tennis player in the world died of carbon monoxide poisoning a while back because his furnace malfunctioned. And so when the furnace turned on to heat his apartment in New York City, the exhaust fumes backed down into his apartment, and carbon monoxide is an odorless gas. And when you're asleep, you don't even know you're breathing it. You just pass out when you sleep and never wake up. Does anybody know the name of that tennis player by any chance? Okay. That was Vitas Gerulaitis. It was maybe before your time. I don't know if any of you played tennis at all. Okay. Yeah, I know it sounds almost like a disease or something, but that was a guy's name. It's actually a dead guy's name, so be nice. Okay, so carbon monoxide is very, very toxic in small concentrations. Okay. So we went over the Herring-Brewer reflex. What does a Herring-Brewer reflex do for you? It prevents overinflation of the lungs. Bicarbonate reaction. Oh, that's something else. Okay, bicarbonate reaction. What's that? How does your body produce bicarbonate? Where does bicarbonate come from? It comes from carbon dioxide that's produced by your tissues. Carbon dioxide is converted into bicarbonate. How does it get converted? What's the name of the enzyme? Carbonic anhydrase, right? Carbonic anhydrase. Okay. Which leads me to, I think, the last topic. All right, so oxygen right here can be transported in the blood very nicely because maybe it doesn't like to just dissolve in blood, but there's something in blood that can carry a lot of oxygen. And what's that? That's hemoglobin, right? And you have millions, hundreds of millions of hemoglobin molecules in every red blood cell. So most of the oxygen in your body is carried but bound to hemoglobin. It's bound to hemoglobin. Carbon dioxide, on the other hand, does not bind very much to hemoglobin, just a couple percent. And carbon dioxide can dissolve into water, okay, a lot more efficiently than oxygen can, right? But that still is not enough to transport carbon dioxide around in your body. And so carbon dioxide, again, another important reason for this reaction, carbon dioxide can be converted into HCO3, which is bicarbonate. And bicarbonate dissolves very easily in water, right? Just like if you were to take some salt and put it in water, what would happen to it? It would just dissolve right in, okay? All right, so most of the carbon dioxide that your body produces is transported in the blood as bicarbonate ion. So where is there high carbon dioxide concentration? In your tissues or your lungs? Where's the highest carbon dioxide concentration? Okay. It's going to be in a tissue that is operating, exercising, for instance, like a muscle, right? When it's utilizing oxygen, producing ATP, it's using up glucose, turning that glucose into carbon dioxide. So tissues produce a lot of carbon dioxide. That's the highest concentration. All right, so if carbon dioxide is at a high concentration because it's being produced, what happens to the level of bicarbonate in the tissues? Does it increase or decrease or stay the same? It increases because of Le Chatelier's principle. It increases because of, what's the name of that enzyme again? Carbonic anhydrase. So in the tissues, carbon dioxide gets converted into bicarbonate. It dissolves in the blood. It's carried by the blood to the lungs. Okay, and then in the lungs, what happens? What happens to this equation right here? In the lungs, what happens to CO2? What about carbon dioxide in the air? What's the, is the concentration of carbon dioxide in the air high or low? It's extremely low. It's almost zero, as a matter of fact. All right, so every time you exhale, carbon dioxide leaves your lungs, and when you inhale, you inhale air that has almost no carbon dioxide in it. So carbon dioxide that's in your lungs or in your blood actually moves into your lungs very rapidly because there's a huge concentration gradient. So when carbon dioxide in your blood goes into the alveolus, how does this chemical reaction work? All right? As CO2 is leaving your blood, what happens to bicarbonate? It gets converted into carbon dioxide because of Le Chatelier's principle, now is working in the opposite direction. Bicarbonate is converted into carbon dioxide. Okay, and that's how carbon dioxide leaves your body. All right, so in the tissues, carbonic anhydrase produces bicarbonate, but in your lungs, bicarbonate is turned into carbon dioxide because carbon dioxide is going to diffuse into the air very rapidly because of that concentration gradient. So those could be a couple of questions for you. How is carbon dioxide carried by your blood? It's two different kinds of concepts. Okay, well let me start with the easy one. How is oxygen carried by your blood? It's what? It's bound to hemoglobin. So it's just bound. It's not changed. It's not modified. It just hops a ride on hemoglobin. Okay, so it hops a ride on hemoglobin. And it loads onto hemoglobin in the lungs because oxygen concentration is high in the lungs. And it jumps off of hemoglobin in the tissues because what's the concentration of oxygen in the tissues? Is it high or low? It's low. So again, it's like Le Chatelier's principle, okay, for loading and unloading of oxygen. So oxygen is carried in the blood bound to hemoglobin. Now what about carbon dioxide? How is it transported in the blood? It's on the board right there. Because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction, it is carried as the bicarbonate ion. So it's carried as bicarbonate. And that just flips back and forth depending on the concentrations of CO2 in the tissues compared to the lungs. It moves back and forth. Okay. All right, so got to make sure you know that bicarbonate reaction. Got to make sure you know your Herring Brewer reflex.
So that carbonic anhydrase reaction is just the carbon dioxide
in
your own
body? Well, so that these two chemical compounds can interconvert. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the reaction goes in the forward direction where carbon dioxide is at a high concentration in your tissues. And this reaction goes in the reverse in parts of your body where carbon dioxide is low. That's in your lungs. Okay? So the effect of that is carbon dioxide goes from your tissues to your lungs into the air because of that carbonic anhydrase reaction. Okay? Okay. Yeah, probably. I don't think I'd ask you to draw it out, but you should be able to like label if you see those chemical compounds. Like CO2? What's the reaction? Oh, you know what? I had it on the board. Got CO2. That's easy. Plus something else. What's that? H2O. That's easy. Producing carbonic acid. H2CO3, And then that's going to produce either a hydrogen ion and HCO3 minus. Okay? So that's carbonic acid, and this is bicarbonate ion. Okay, and in terms of local control of perfusion, what could you tell me about the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation? Local control of perfusion. How do you control perfusion in a tissue? How do you control perfusion? What's perfusion? Perfusion is blood flow. Perfusion is blood flow. How do you control blood flow to different parts of your body? Vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Okay? So, who could tell me the difference between the systemic circulation and pulmonary circulation? They're switched, right? So, in the systemic circulation, when a tissue is low on oxygen, what do you have? Constriction or dilation? You have dilation, right? You have vasodilation in the systemic circulation, which is going to bring oxygen to that tissue. But in the lungs, how is it? Do you want to have blood going to a part of the lung that has no oxygen? No. So decreased oxygen then causes vasoconstriction. So it's opposite. So blood goes to the parts of the lung that have oxygen, because that's the purpose of blood going to the lungs, to pick up oxygen. Right? So it would be futile to have blood going to some part of the lung that doesn't have oxygen. Okay? So we call that perfusion ventilation matching. Perfusion of blood compared to ventilation, which is air moving in and out of the lungs. It has to match up. Okay, then you got to know how CO2 is carried in the blood, how oxygen is carried in the blood. You got to know something about the chemoreceptors that regulate ventilation. Where are the three places where you have chemoreceptors? Medulla, number one. Medulla. Medulla and pons is the same place. That's a respiratory center. We just say medulla. Okay? Just say the medulla. All right? And those we call the central receptors. Okay? And the other we call peripheral receptors. Where are the peripheral receptors located? The carotid body. Yeah, the arch of the... Oh, no. The carotid sinus. Sorry. Carotid bodies and the carotid sinus and the aortic bodies. And the arch of the aorta. Okay. Which chemical is the most sensitive for controlling ventilation? Is it carbon dioxide? Yes, carbon dioxide. And is it increasing carbon dioxide or decreasing carbon dioxide that's going to stimulate respiration? Increasing CO2. Which one of those receptors is the most sensitive for monitoring or for stimulating respiration? That's the most sensitive to carbon dioxide. It's the central receptors in the medulla that are going to be the most powerful for stimulating ventilation. Okay. And don't forget, CO2 can't cross the blood-brain barrier. So CO2 in your blood moves into the cerebrospinal fluid, and then it gets converted into hydrogen ions, right? It gets converted into carbonic acid, and then it's the acid that stimulates the respiratory center in the medulla. See what else we got. Okay, what about the, where do you find chemoreceptors for oxygen concentration? If anybody can remember. So we got the three. We got the medulla, we got the aortic bodies and the carotid bodies. Which one have receptors for oxygen? There's only one. It's the carotid bodies up over here. Carotid bodies have the chemoreceptors for oxygen. And those work, they can stimulate ventilation only when oxygen concentration falls drastically. Those, then they have an effect on respiration. Otherwise, no. Okay. What about exam? What are the exam figures in this chapter? Okay, I think they're the pulmonary volumes, right? Yeah, the spirometry volumes. Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay, so just that one figure. That's pretty easy. All right, well, we can do a review now. Since I'm done talking about respiration, if anybody wants to ask me questions, I could ask you questions. Well, what's the difference between agglutination and coagulation? What is coagulation? Coagulation. Think in terms of a molecule. What's happening in terms of molecules? Okay, I'm not sure I heard anybody. In terms of molecules, coagulation, what's happening? Okay, it's a three-step process. What's the third step? What's forming during that third step? Fibrin formation, right? Fibrin formation. So fibrinogen gets converted to fibrin. So what converts fibrinogen to fibrin? Yeah, thrombin, right? So thrombin isn't active in your, well, so what can you tell me about fibrinogen, even if you don't know anything about coagulation? It's inactive, and thrombin activates it, turns it into fibrin, okay? Well, how does thrombin get going? How does it know when to do its job? Is thrombin always active in your blood?
No.
It's made and stored in your blood as another inactive form, prothrombin. All right, so when you have damage to a blood vessel, prothrombin gets converted to thrombin. And so what's the active element that changes prothrombin to thrombin? Don't forget, prothrombin means it's inactive, right? Just like ogen at the end of the word, pro at the beginning of a word means it's inactive. It's the prothrombin activator. Prothrombin activator. So actually, it sort of makes sense if you look at it a couple times. Okay, so prothrombin activator converts prothrombin to thrombin. And prothrombin activator is formed when you have damage to a blood vessel and the connective tissue is exposed to blood. And the active compound there that has to be exposed is collagen. That's just the fundamental chemical that we find in connective tissue, right, is collagen. So that's going to produce prothrombin activator. Prothrombin activator makes thrombin, and thrombin makes fibrin. And then you have a nice clot, a net, that can trap blood cells and platelets. Okay. All right, what about agglutination? Do you need thrombin for agglutination? No, you don't. Do you need fibrin for agglutination? Bless you. Do you need fibrin for agglutination? No, you don't. What is the underlying molecular reason for agglutination? What is it? It's a reaction between two things. What two things? It's a reaction between an antibody and an antigen. That is agglutination. So red blood cells actually get stuck together. It's like you make just a big, huge chain of red blood cells all attached to each other. So where do you find antigens? Okay, so you find antigen and antibodies in your circulatory system, but a little bit more specifically, where do you find antigens? On the cell membrane, right? They're sticking on the cell membrane. And where do you find antibodies? They're floating around in the plasma. They're dissolved in the water of plasma. All right, and don't forget, an antibody has these two hands, and it can grab an antigen. How is it going to know what antigen to grab? By the shape, right? And so what's one shape of an antigen that we learned about? A, yeah. What's the second shape we learned about? B. Right, and then there are some cells that don't have any of those shapes. What do we call that? O, right? So those are the three basic kinds of blood types. In the ABO system, you got blood type A, you got blood type B, and you got blood type O that doesn't have any antigens on the cell surface. All right, and what's another one? AB. Okay, plus AB. If you have both the A and B antigens, then we call that AB. That's for the ABO system. And then we looked at another system. That's the RH. And that is very simple. There's only one kind of antigen. And if you have that antigen on the cell surface, you're plus. But if you don't have it on there, you're O. No, that has to do with AB system. Right? The RH, if you don't have the antigen, then you're what we say minus. You're either RH plus or RH minus. Okay. What chapter was that? That was the first chapter. Oh, yeah. Then what's the most important short-term regulation mechanism for blood pressure? How do you regulate blood pressure from second to second in your body? Most important short-term regulation of blood pressure. It's a reflex. Okay. For blood pressure, it's called the baroreceptor reflex. What is a baroreceptor measure? Blood pressure. Right. And as your blood pressure goes down, because maybe you change body position, like when you stand up right after class, your blood pressure is going to go down. The baroreceptors measure that. Okay, what are some ways that blood pressure can be adjusted by your body? We had that on the board not too long ago. What is that equal to? Stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. Right, so as soon as you stand up, your blood pressure drops. That's going to stimulate the sympathetic nervous system. Now you should relate this to a nice response loop, right? What does a response loop always start with? Stimulus, which is a decrease in blood pressure. What monitors that decrease in blood pressure? The baroreceptor, and the afferent pathway takes it to the medulla, which is the integration center, and in the integration center it has a value which we call the set point for normal blood pressure. What's your normal blood pressure? Should be 120 over 80, and if it drops below that, all right, the integration center is going to make a decision and says your blood pressure is dropping, let's increase it. How can the cardioregulatory center increase your blood pressure? By issuing commands to the ventricles to contract more strongly, right? That would be a positive inotropic effect. It will send signals to the SA node, okay, to increase heart rate. We call that a positive chronotropic effect. It can send signals to blood vessels to vasoconstrict, right? And if any of these increase, or if they all increase, what happens to blood pressure? It increases because these are all what, directly related or inversely related? They're directly related, okay? So that's the baroreceptor reflex. Happens at a moment's notice. Or if your blood pressure goes too high, what's going to happen? Okay? Not the sympathetic nervous system, but the parasympathetic nervous system will be activated by the medulla or cardioregulatory center to decrease heart rate and to decrease resistance. But the vagus nerve can't adjust stroke volume. Okay, that's one funny thing about the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so that what kind of mechanism is that? Is that for short-term or long-term regulation of blood pressure? That's short-term. What kind of mechanism is important for long-term regulation of blood pressure? Involves the kidneys. How about the, yes, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. That's the important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. Because what is it going to do? It's going to regulate blood volume. Okay, it's going to regulate venous return to the heart. So when blood volume decreases, venous return to the heart decreases. So when venous return to the heart decreases, what can you tell me about stretching of the heart? If you don't have as much blood filling the heart up, what happens? It starts to shrink, right? And as the heart shrinks, what happens to the force of contraction of the heart? Does it stay the same or decrease or increase? It decreases. All right, so what do we call that law? Where the law says that as the heart stretches, it beats with a stronger force of contraction. As the heart shrinks, it gets weaker. Okay? Not quite the Herring Brewer reflex. I thought I heard that. That has to do with inflation of the lungs. But that is, it's a law of the heart, an intrinsic law of the heart, just a property of the heart. The Frank Starling law of the heart, right? Okay, so the Frank Starling law of the heart will adjust the stroke volume. As venous return decreases, the heart won't beat with the same contraction force. Stroke volume will go down, blood pressure will go down due to the Frank Starling law of the heart. What are some other good things? Well, you know, you got to know your action potential for the heart. You got two different kinds of action potentials. You've got nodal cells versus myocardial cells. Why can't a myocardial cell go into tetanus? Why can't the heart just go into full contraction? Because, did you say refractory period? Okay, I like refractory period. The refractory period in a heart cell, a cardiac muscle cell, is long. Okay, why is it long? Because if you look at an action potential, there's something in a heart cell that you don't see anywhere else. All right, let's just quickly look at a neuron. So here is a neuron. So what's this right here? What's this right here? So what are we measuring? We're looking at voltage versus time. So this is RMP, resting membrane potential, right? And then this is a stimulus. How do we create a stimulus in a neuron? We put a positive charge inside the cell, causing it to move up, right? So this is positive in this direction. Like sodium enters a cell, that makes it positive. And then what's this here? That's threshold. And when it reaches threshold, oh, something really weird happens. What happens? Yeah, a bunch of sodium channels open up because they're voltage dependent. As soon as the membrane potential reaches that voltage, they open up. And so what do we call that? This is part of an action potential, but this is just the first part. Depolarization, right? And then you got repolarization due to who? No, it's got to have... It's got to be potassium leaving the cell. So depolarization, sodium. This is just a neuron. Just a neuron. Okay, I'm just going back to what you know already. So here's a neuron. Depolarization is sodium going in. Repolarization due to potassium going out. You got a little area of hyperpolarization right here. So this is just what? This is the absolute refractory period. Now let's look at an action potential on a muscle cell, a myocardium muscle cell. All right, you got resting membrane potential, and then what happens? What's that? That is depolarization. Okay, and then what does it look like? Like that. This is what we call the plateau region. So this depolarization is due to sodium going in. This plateau is due to calcium going in, and this is due to potassium leaving. So you don't have any calcium channels over here for a neuron, but you do for the myocardial cells. And so now your refractory period is extended, this whole big long time like that. So the action potential lasts pretty much for the whole duration of a muscle twitch. So the heart can't go into tetanus, which is a fantastic thing, because what would happen if your heart went into tetanus? You wouldn't be walking down the sidewalk and say, oh, look at that nice, big, strong, bulging heart that I have right here, right? Like if that happened to your biceps or something. Because when the heart's contracted, what can you tell me about venous return to the heart? The heart has to fill with blood first so that when it ever does contract again, it can eject some blood. But if the heart is contracted, blood can't fill the heart, and it's never going to pump blood again. All right, so that's a terrible thing. All right, so action potential. What can you tell me, what does the action potential for a nodal fiber look like, a nodal fiber? Is there really such a thing as a resting membrane potential in a nodal fiber? No, it's always going to be depolarizing. All right, as soon as that nodal fiber is repolarized, it's going to start depolarizing again automatically. What kind of channels open up on a nodal cell? And what kind of channels are those? They're called HCN channels. Okay, they're a sodium channel, but they're a special channel that just automatically opens up. And the slope of that, and what do we call that? So what does a nodal cell look like? So here's voltage. It's what? And let's just say this is threshold right here. Okay. So what do we call this right here? This is a, instead of resting membrane potential, which would be flat, a nodal cell looks like that. That's called a pacemaker potential due to those HCN channels. And then when it reaches threshold, it depolarizes and then repolarizes. And then when it gets down back to this level, what happens? The HCN channels open up again. When it reaches threshold, that just happens all over again. So don't forget pacemaker potential. So these action potentials are a lot different looking. What's the easiest way to tell the action potential from a cardiac fiber cell, a cardiac muscle fiber cell? What does it have? So you should be able to see from like in the back of the room. If I showed you an action potential from a cardiac muscle cell, contractile cell, even from across the room, you could say, oh yeah, that's a myocardial cell. How could you tell? Because of the plateau region. Yeah, the big flat region in the action potential due to the plateau region. Maybe I should do that during the test. No. Everybody go in the back of the room and I'll just show it here. The final question. Say it again. Oh, you can't see. Yeah, I can't hear. Well, I think that's all I got to say, except the test is a week from today. Okay, if you have questions, you'll have to give me an email. My office hours are posted on my door. The secretaries have my office hours. And I think I have office hours on this Thursday, but not Wednesday or Friday. So I do have office hours on Thursday. Yeah. No, not same time, because I have tests to give. Okay. But you'd have to snoop around and find out when they are.